What's up, y'all? Kelly Clarkson with Wayfair. My favorite thing about the holidays? Decking out my whole house. It's not a competition, but if it was, well, I'd win the season with Wayfair. Outdoor inflatable Santa? Got it on Wayfair. Trees, lights, and ornaments? Wayfair. Hosting must-haves like dining sets, beds, sheets, and towels? Wayfair. For everything in your style delivered with fast and free shipping, visit Wayfair.com or the Wayfair app to win the season. But again, it's not a competition.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
So that was Mrs. Lundegaard on the floor in there. And I guess that was your accomplice and the wood chipper. And those three people in Brainerd. And for what? For a little bit of money. There's more to life than a little money, you know. Don't you know that?
Hello and welcome once again to The Cinephiles, where we are continuing our season of the Coen brothers with our conclusion of their incredible film, Fargo. My name is Steve Morris. I'm a filmmaker and directing instructor in Los Angeles, California.
Hello, my name is John Roca. I'm a writer, producer, host, and voiceover artist in San Diego, California.
And we've been so excited to dig into Fargo, and we've gotten an incredible response. It's so fun now. We're seeing comments on Spotify where people are discussing the film. We're seeing comments on Facebook, on Twitter and Instagram. And of course, one of the best places to have interactions with true cinephiles is on patreon.com/thecinephiles. And we could not make this show without our incredible supporters there.
Absolutely. Another way you can support the show, Steve, is when you listen to us on the podcast, and if you don't have the commercial-free version and you listen to the commercials, there are codes for some of the products and services that the companies that sponsor us put out there. And if you're interested in using any of those products, please make sure you use our code. That's what helps people. That's what helps these companies come back and support us month after month with what we do. And of course, Awaken 180, the new red raspberries have jumped on here for us, Steve, and True Diagnostic is still out there for us as well. So a lot of really great people who are sponsoring our show and supporting our show. So we'd love it if you sponsor them right back.
But right now, I think we need to head to the celebrity room where Steve Buscemi, Carl, is enjoying a lovely evening of entertainment with a beautiful guest as he listens to the song stylings of the great Jose Feliciano.
This is another thing that makes the film so unusual. I mean, to choose Jose Feliciano, it's a stroke of brilliance. Of course, he'd probably have a sold-out show there in the Midwest there in the mid-90s here, where he's still, performing and living off Chico and the Man, the theme song, living off Light My Fire, living off Have Yourself, I Want to Wish You a Merry Christmas. Like, Jose is such an interesting act. And of course, for me growing up as a Latino, this was one of those rare artists that I knew growing up in the 70s and 80s. And so it was such a smile on my face when I saw this movie the first time and he popped up.
What I love is that Carl is genuinely enthused.
Yes.
To get to see Jose Feliciano. There's this moment, I always think about it. There's an episode of The Simpsons where Bart, Milhouse, and Nelson all steal a rental car and they end up at a show and Nelson is enthralled because they went to see Andy Williams. And he's like,
I didn't think he was going to do Moon River, but then bam, second encore.
I don't know why this makes me think of this moment, but here we have this criminal Carl who is just thrilled to bring this prostitute to see this great show. And what's so funny is watching him trying to get a reaction out of her to be enthusiastic for this great entertainment that he's seen.
Have you been to the celebrity room before with other clients?
I don't think so. Nice.
Yeah, well, depends on the artist. You know, Jose Feliciano, you got no complaints.
Yeah, he's trying to cosplay as this kind of high roller who's got himself an escort. But they're not in Vegas. They're not rolling in the high room. He doesn't have a lot of money, but he's trying to impress her in that way, and she could care less. And by the way, this is Michelle Hutchinson who plays the escort in this. She's been on Lady Dynamite and a few other films like My Best Friend's Wedding and what have you. But she is there and she is just not giving him what he wants because she just wants to get to the sex and get it over with and get her money. It's hilarious.
And it's also similar to what he's been trying to get out of Garrick the whole time, which is I'm going to talk. You're going to talk back.
Yes.
That's all he wants. At the moment, I love, and I mean, we've all had awkward conversation moments, but one is fantastic, which is that he's continuing to ask your questions and then he, trying to make conversation, he says,
"How long you work for the escort service?"
"I don't know, a few months."
"Find that work interesting, do you?"
She says, "What are you talking about?"
Initially she's like giving him what he wants a little bit because he's displaying everything. "You ever been to the room? Have you been to this kind of stuff?" And I think there's two really interesting moments in this whole situation. Like he's trying to show off how big he is. And then when he yells waiter and the waiter just walks right by ignoring him. And this is the thing about Carl. And I would not fault people who watch this movie and maybe feel a little bit of pity for Carl, because Carl clearly is a runt of a kid who probably grew up with parents who didn't love him, in situations where he was constantly bullied in school. And unfortunately, he didn't have that extra strength to figure out how to do something with his life and make money doing it legitimately. So he became a criminal, fell into this kind of world of becoming a criminal. But like the only thing he really wants is to be able to connect to someone. And the whole movie, as you point out so well, Steve, he is trying to connect with someone who will talk to him and give him a back and forth and make him feel valued. And he doesn't have that, even from an escort who he is paying to pay attention to him. He's not getting that attention. Or a waiter who's depending on tips from him is not paying attention to him when he wants his champagne glass filled again or whatever. So it is sad and hilarious at the same time.
I think this is such a great point, because really Carl and Jerry are both terrible people.
Yes.
And
yes,
I feel bad for both of them multiple times in this movie. Right. That is a really interesting hat trick that it can pull off of, like, I'm going to show you just how awful these people are.
Right.
And yet you're still going to feel some sympathy and some humor with what they're going through.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. And of course, as you said, like, yes, she is trying to give him what she wants on a professional level. And we cut to a scene where she's trying to give him what he wants on a physical level, because she's on top of him. They're having sex. And oh my God, the lines she has of like,
"I'm hearing bells. Come on. All right. Well, where are you?
Huh? Hearing bells." I have never paid for an escort, never contemplated paying for an escort. I can only imagine why people do it. And I'm sure there are a variety of reasons why people do it. And so it is what it is. I have no judgment on it, but I love that she's just so whatever about the whole situation and getting it done. So this is someone who is kind of pathetic paying for, and probably bought the least affordable, like the cheapest escort he could find, because he's probably a cheapskate as well. So this is the kind of interaction he's having, and she's just going through the motions so it can be over with, you know? So it's hilarious.
I'll tell you what I think, and you really made me think of this, is that I think what he's actually paying for, she thinks he's paying for sex. Mm-hmm. But what he's 100%. Actually paying for is he wants the conversation.
Yes.
If she had just done a better improv at the Jose Feliciano, he would not have so much trouble finishing his business in the sex scene.
Probably not.
I think it's her professionalism that is, you know, that's the issue that's going on here. But of course, we're still not going to get very far, because all of a sudden, in the midst of the sex, it is shocking what happens, is that she gets dragged off of him screaming.
Yeah.
"Shit, what the hell are you doing? I'm banging that girl."
And then someone slaps his face and tosses him naked over this couch.
Oof. It is a brutal, this whole scene is brutal, because, you know, Shep hasn't said much, but we've sensed that Shep is the quiet type who would, like, you know, just kind of at a moment's notice might unleash. And then we see this ferocity of anger, and we see how absolutely strong this man is, you know, and how unsettling he is when he uses his strength. So you understand why he was a criminal. You understand why he was in jail and had problems with things, and how he made these connections. So, you know, you don't always have to have a bunch of dialogue to give the background on a character. Just a scene like this, where the character has been slowly introduced scene by scene, and then seeing him explode in the way that he does, from tossing him around, beating up his neighbor, kicking the woman down the hall, and then pulling his belt off and whipping him like a child. It is brutal, Steve. Absolutely brutal. And scary.
It's terrifying. I mean, Shep is absolutely terrifying, unstoppable. And like, there's even the moment where he's got the belt around him from behind and he's lifting him off the ground. He easily could have killed Carl in this moment.
Right.
And then it's just, as you say, whipping him like a child.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he's got the sex still on him. Like it is, I can't imagine what that whole situation was like. You know what I'm saying? And what is going on for Carl as he's experiencing this whole situation, because it comes out of left field. And this is probably Carl, like, you know, I spent my money, I got an escort, I'm going to at least have some sex. Like, finally, I get a little bit of peace for one night. But even this one night, he can't have any peace because Shep shows up and just kicks the shit out of him. And I don't know what the ramifications are for him with his neighbor, too, who knocked on the door. You know, as loud as people are, I try to never knock on the door, especially if I'm in a seedy hotel or a seedy apartment building. You just deal with it because you never know what's on the other side of the door when you knock on it, man.
Yeah. And he is beating him, yelling at him, and there's this musical build and then this hard cut to him on the payphone. And it is so clear that he is smarting from that beating.
Oh, yeah.
All right, Jerry, I'm through fucking around. You got the fucking money?
Yeah, I got the money, but...
parking ramp, top level, 30 minutes, Jerry, we wrap this thing up.
And Jerry's trying to talk to him.
Right.
Okay, but,
Hey, you're there in 30 minutes or I find you, Jerry, and I shoot you, and I shoot your fucking wife, and I shoot all your little fucking children, and I shoot them all in the back of their little fucking heads. You got it?
So scary. And look, as we've said, Steve, in the previous installments of our breakdown of Fargo, he is a guy, Carl is a guy who has no power in his life. And we just, you know, kind of talked about it for a few minutes here earlier. And so what does he do when he's had the woman ripped off of him, he's been whipped by his friend, he immediately turns on the person who he sees weaker than him, and that is Jerry, gets on the phone with him and threatens Jerry's wife, threatens Jerry's kids, wants to move along the situation so he can get his money, so he can feel in power again, right? And so that's why he's jumping on the phone with Jerry at this time. He could have waited a day or two, could have, you know, healed from the wounds, but no, it's immediately on a payphone, yelling at Jerry to give him his money once and for all so he can feel powerful again.
Now, and I don't actually think that Carl is a person who would go kill all these people, including killing a bunch of kids. I don't think that's likely behavior from
Probably
Carl.
Not.
But I also think there's a distinction between Jerry and Carl. These are both ineffectual people.
Yes.
But Carl is capable of making this very scary speech and probably is far more capable of scary things than Jerry physically. You know what I mean? Like, the reason I bring it up is there's like a status difference or a power dynamic difference between the ineffectual Carl and the even more ineffectual Jerry.
Yeah, because each of them use different tactics to achieve the ends. They use different means to achieve the ends. And that is, Carl uses his threats of violence and his gun because that's what he knows. He's a criminal. Jerry uses his words to manipulate and play the sad sack so he can get what he wants. And so they use two different tactics, but I think both of them are nefarious in their intentions and in their desires to get what they want, you know?
And the moment of the, again, ineffectual Jerry saying,
okay, now you stay away from Scotty now.
Okay, let's talk about that moment, Steve, because for the first time ever, it occurred to me that Jerry is surrendering his son because he says, you stay, why does he give the son's name at all? And I think that's because he said children, plural, which means Carl doesn't even know how many children
Jerry
has.
Wait. You think that Jerry is actually willing to sell out his own child at this moment?
1,000,000%. 1,000,000%. You don't give a man who just threatened your family and has no idea how many children you have by using the plural children, you don't give him the name of your child. See, I think Carl is angling for, or sorry, Jerry is angling for a complete break from this life. He's going to screw Wade over. He's not going to save his wife. And he's going to serve up his son to these people so he can have a full break. And guess what? He gets to be the white Mike Yanagita. He gets to now give the speeches to whatever unwitting woman and play the sad sack and try to get them into bed, try to get them to marry him. Like, he is a con artist in the making here. And I think it's unsettling if you really, as we're breaking it down, if you break down these little exchanges, why is he surrendering information to these people in the way that he is? And it's, I think it's because he does low-key want them out of his life.
You know? I think this brings up a really interesting point because what it makes you realize, and I don't, my gut is not what you just said, although I have no evidence against what you just said, is that, well, and that's what's so interesting to me is like, I really don't know what the fuck Jerry's thinking.
Yeah.
I really don't. Like, it is so, I mean, because my response to the Scotty thing is just, because everything you said is correct. You should not say the name of your child.
No.
To the, that's a, but to me, it's always been, well, there's Jerry doing another fucking stupid thing because he's a moron. Like, not, I'm not thinking of it as a Machiavellian sense, like, I'm going to sell out my kid and, you know.
See, that's why people get over it, because they always think, oh, no, he's not. And I was thinking, no, I always think the worst of people once they go down this path. Because I just don't, I don't buy people who are being, oh, I accidentally surrendered all this information. No way. I don't buy it. I think it's some, in somewhere inside of you, you knew what you were doing. You just don't want to face it. You know,
I think
that's why you and I are different. You always think better of people than I do.
Well, it's also, but there's another piece of this.
Yeah.
He's like, that's true. But the other fundamental difference is I actually think you think people are smarter than I think they are.
Oh, well, that's fair too. I do think people are smarter. Right. That's a fair point, Steve. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I always go to the sentence I always think of is in All the President's Men, where they're talking to Hal Holbrook and he says, you got to remember, these guys aren't that smart. That to me is so, I think from all politics today, and we won't go into it, there's so much of it. I was like, these guys are a bunch of fucking morons. Like that's, I'm so much more willing to think that people are stupid usually than evil. And you're more willing to think that they're smarter and eviler than I'd think.
Yeah. I think they're more conniving than, agreed. But we also have to throw in this, and some of our people, some of our listeners here might be thinking this as well. Wade is on the other line. So does he say Scotty to get Wade to go? But he's frustrated that Wade goes. So you have to ask yourself why he says Scotty's name. What is the intention? And it's not really mapped out. So it's left for us as the audience to decide why he would surrender Scotty's name when he knows Wade is on the phone with him as well and with Jerry and Carl.
Well, it also goes into the, there's this investment statement of like past performance is not an indicator of future results. And that's like sort of their disclaimer that they would put everywhere. Mm. I actually think most of the time past performance is evidence of future results.
Fair point.
Is that Jerry has in his head, I've been ineffectual all my life. Wade has never listened to me.
Yeah.
Nothing has ever gone the way that I've gone. But this one time, everything is going to work out and everybody's going to listen to me. And no. That is actually not going to happen at all.
100%.
You should assume it's going to go exactly the way it's gone before, which is what happens because they hang up the phone. And the minute they hang up the phone, Wade is ready to go. He's putting on his parka. He's got his briefcase of money. He's heading to the car.
Yeah. And Jerry's frustrated. He stands in the hallway there, you know, throwing his arms around and putting on his boots because now he's going after to see what's going to happen here.
Yeah. And just... because I know where the story is going to go, the final moment with Scotty asking him where he's going, it's like, yeah, the next time you see your dad, you are going to know what a goddamn horrible fucking person he is.
Or you're never going to see your dad because he's going to take all that money, possibly shoot his wife or have them shoot his wife and take off. I don't know.
But except we know that what's happening, and the next time he's going to see his dad's going to be in jail. That's true. So according to the National Institutes of Health, as many as 30 million men in the U.S. experience ED. It's more common than a bad night's sleep. The worst part is the way past experiences can sap your confidence and add stress at, let's face it, the worst possible time. But with Hims, confidence isn't a problem, so you can skip the guesswork and stay cool and focused on the task at hand. Hims offers access to ED treatment options ranging from trusted generics that cost 95% less than brand names to hard mints if prescribed. This isn't a one-size-fits-all operation that will forget you in the waiting room. For the medical professionals at Hims, your health comes first, and they'll make sure you get exactly what you need. To get simple online access to personalized affordable care for ED, hair loss, weight loss, and more, visit hims.com/thecinephiles. That's hims.com/thecinephiles for your free online visit. hims.com/CINEFILES. Actual price will depend on product and subscription plan. Featured products include compound drug products, which the FDA does not approve or verify for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. See website for details, restrictions, and important safety information.
Hey, Cinephiles fans, the holidays are almost here, and if you still have names on your list, Don't panic. Uncommon Goods makes holiday shopping stress-free and joyful with thousands of one-of-a-kind gifts you can't find anywhere else. You'll discover presents that feel meaningful and personal, never rushed or last minute. You know, right now it's Oscar season with all these films coming out that are vying for nominations next year. And I went to the Uncommon Goods website and they have this incredible book that you can give as a gift. It's called The History of the Oscars. From the LA Times here, it features 250 plus pages of original Oscar coverage from 1929 to the present, and you can personalize it with a name on the cover and a heartfelt message inside at no extra cost for that film lover on your list. Uncommon Goods has something for everyone, though, and with every purchase you make at Uncommon Goods, they give back $1 to a nonprofit partner of your choice. So don't wait. Make this holiday the year you give something truly unforgettable. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/cinephiles. That's uncommongoods.com/CINEFILES for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods, we're all out of the ordinary. So, Steve, it looks like we have a new sponsor on the Cinephiles, and I understand you've gotten some good use out of them.
Dude, since we've been working with Secret Nature, my sleep's been better, my stress level is down, and I've been more productive.
Wow, that sounds like a major change knowing you.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, between the podcast, being a dad, and I mean, the world,
yeah.
I wasn't exactly in top form. But when I tried the Secret Nature Daytime Gummy, I got like a clean, cool feeling. I mean, I could feel my shoulders literally dropping down a couple of inches. And I was able to stop focusing on a whole bunch of things I couldn't control and sit down to deal with some of the things I could.
That's fantastic. I know a lot of people would love to feel this way. And your sleep is better too?
Oh, yeah. I used to wake up all the time and not be able to get back to sleep. But Secret Nature has a great nighttime gummy that not only helps me sleep through the night, but I am waking up refreshed and focused.
That's great, brother. I love that. And if you all want to try Secret Nature gummies, you can get 30% off your first order at secretnature.com with the code CINEFILES. That's secretnature.com, code CINEFILES. Try them out today.
Wade is driving off to this meeting, talking to himself, you know, practicing his lines just the way Jerry practices.
Just
lines.
The way Jerry. I think this is so great, Steve, because once again, this, as I mentioned in the first film, I know, and I saw somebody comment angrily about our conversation on Fargo and talking about masculinity. I don't know why you're listening to our show if you have an issue with exploring all the possible motives for why men and women do what they do in these films. If you are, you might be listening to the wrong show. Not that I want to guide anyone away from us, but yes, I will talk about masculinity in men on this show all the time. Here is Wade, who's been presented as this gruff, no-nonsense, old-school, toxic masculine guy from the 50s when men were men and Burt Lancaster was the paragon of virtue and all this stuff. And here he is himself talking to himself to buck himself up, to get himself in the right mindset, to make sure he says the right words to this guy to show that he's no one to fuck around with, which is the exact same thing that Jerry did before he got on the phone to talk to Wade about the kidnapping. So it does undercut that there is a fallacy to this toxic masculinity that we seem to just all accept that some dudes are just going to be like, that's right, I'm a badass. When inside, they're just as nervous or scared in different ways as anybody who isn't as much of a badass, at least outwardly in the world, you know?
You know, we talked many times about the Dunning-Kruger effect, which is your ability to judge your ability at something is based on your ability. I think one of the places where it's most out of whack is how much of a badass do you think you are?
Right, yes.
Most men have a way higher opinion of their badassery than is in fact. Well, and this goes to the thing I said
look
before.
If you look at social media, they absolutely do. But yeah. God, yes, yeah.
I mean, like, I have been around a couple of badasses. Mm-hmm. There are a couple of people who I, particularly in martial arts, there are a few people was like, oh, that person can kick the fuck living shit out of me.
Yes.
Like, I'm not remotely in this person's league. But those people are pretty rare.
Yes.
There are not that many of them.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Like, Shep Proudfoot, I mean, but say what you want. That's a scary fucking dude. You do not want to fuck with that guy.
Yeah.
You know?
She wasn't intimidated by him in that room.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? So there are some people who can see through those acts, because I bet Shep has like trained himself to be this way in order to survive in this world. I mean, this is the Midwest as a Native American. I imagine, and he's a criminal. So I imagine he has to
radiate a certain veneer of badassery in order to survive. You know?
Well, and the thing is, and this is maybe too much of a digression for us, but there, you know, there's this concept, and I know that the police train in this idea, but this concept of dominance is like, I need to establish dominance.
Right.
Dominance works for a whole bunch of stuff. It doesn't work for a whole bunch of other stuff. We see Wade is clearly dominating Jerry.
Yeah.
You know, and Georg is clearly dominating Carl. So, right. And Shep can dominate people physically.
Right.
But Shep can't dominate Marge.
Right.
Doesn't work there. And in fact, Stan has found ways to work with Wade that sidesteps the dominance because of his expertise.
He doesn't play into it.
Yeah, he doesn't play into it, you know? And so, and I've known, I mean, I'm sure you have too. There are a lot of dudes out there who are just like, I'm going to walk in like I'm the toughest motherfucker in the room and I'm going to push other people around.
Yeah.
And frequently, and then sometimes they get called out and we discover that they weren't actually the toughest motherfucker in the room.
They're much more sensitive. You know, if you're going to push, you know, for example, if you push world leaders around to try to make sure you're at the front of some summit and then you're crying about, you know, people exposing certain things about your behavior, how much of a badass are you really? You know what I'm saying?
So we're up on the rooftop.
Yeah.
Wade pulls up. I think this is a great setup to a situation because we have no idea where this is going to fucking go.
Right.
You know?
Because he's not expecting Wade to show up.
Who the fuck are you?
And Wade, as he has done in every business deal forever, blusters his way in there, assuming he can win this argument with this penny ante criminal.
I got your damn money. Now where's my daughter?
And Carl is pissed.
I am through fucking around. Drop that fucking briefcase.
Where's my daughter?
Fuck you, man. Where's Jerry? I gave simple fucking instructions.
Where's my damn daughter? No Gene, no money.
What I love is that Wade is 100% confident that he can win over this situation.
Yeah, he gets that kind of wide-eyed look in his eye trying to bully him with his eyes and his tone and his voice. But I think he caught Carl on the wrong night. Maybe another night, if Carl had had enjoyable escort sex and was okay with this and set this all up and Wade showed up, I don't know that Carl would have as much of a reaction. But Carl is disrespected yet again. This is the third person disrespecting him within a few hours here, from the escort to Shep and now Jerry, by not showing up himself with the money and sending someone that Carl doesn't know. It's even more disrespect. And Wade is like, no, where's my daughter? No daughter, no money. And Carl keeps saying, is this a fucking joke? Are you guys not serious about this? And then without a moment's hesitation, he pulls out that pistol and shoots him straight up.
Is this a fucking joke here?
Wade doesn't try to move. Wade doesn't try to block it. Wade just takes it. And it's such a weird reaction, Steve. What are your thoughts on this? Because when Wade gets shot, a smile crawls across his lips for just a second. And then he starts to descend onto the ground after having been shot. So it's such an interesting interaction between these two guys.
What you point out that's so important, he doesn't pull out a gun to threaten him.
No.
He doesn't pull out a gun to say, hey, you should shut up. You could get hurt. I could kill you. I might shoot you. He doesn't do any of that. Mm-hmm. He fucking shoots him.
Kills him. He murders him.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And we had said before when the cop was there, we had asked the question, has Carl ever shot anyone before?
Yeah.
And both you and I felt that he hadn't. And so I totally agree with you. Had this been another night without the Shep thing and without everything that's gone on, I don't think he shoots Wade. But man, it is so fast and so callous. And I think the actor playing Wade's reaction is fantastic.
Yes.
Just this moment of sort of, to me, I see it as like total disconnected denial of the reality of what has just happened. It's like, I was shot. Like, am I shot? Really? And then the realization, you know what I mean? Like, oh my God, I think he just killed me, you know?
Yeah. It's a weird thing. And I'll say this because I mean, the thing that he's, you know, representative of the toxic masculinity, when he shoots him, I think he's surprised that he would actually shoot him. And by the way, he shoots him point blank. He's like, there's literally like 6 inches between the gun and Wade's jacket. And Wade, as I said, it registered him and there's a smile. I think there's a smile because I bet Wade was a guy who watched a lot of Westerns and watched a lot of manhood movies, but was probably never in a situation where he actually had to fight his way out of something, right? So, but he always fancied himself as a tough guy because of business, as you mentioned, Steve. So the smile is almost in a way like, oh, this happened. Like, this is what it feels like. And then the realization, oh shit, I've been shot. And that's where the face comes as he hits the ground. Like, this is what it feels like, but this is the reality now. And that's, eventually motivates him to pull out his gun and shoot Carl in the face. And he wings him in the face. He's right there in front of Carl and he misses him, which tells me that Wade, you know, wasn't a strong enough man or didn't have his wits about him to handle the situation, as you said, because he has a higher opinion of his manhood than he actually has, you know? And so he shoots him. He almost completely misses Carl, and it's a terrible shot, but it's a painful one.
It's brutal. I mean, it's a very brutal and real. It feels very like it isn't gunslingers shooting each other with pinpoint accuracy.
Right.
It's morons who are just like muddling through. I also think, you know, since I already brought up the Dunning-Kruger effect, I'll bring up a side effect of it, which is that there is a thing, which is where someone excels or has high levels of skill in one area.
Yeah.
They just automatically assume that they can apply that to all areas.
Yeah.
So Wade is a successful businessman who's been very successful in multiple businesses.
Right.
So naturally he's smart enough to deal with criminals and hostage situations and all those things. It doesn't ever occur to him that he is a complete novice when it comes to money exchanges and things like that. I mean, I don't know whether Wade's never shot anybody.
Fucking shit!
And he goes up and just shoots Wade multiple times, killing him.
Yeah, it's fascinating that Wade doesn't shoot more than once. Wade has the jump on him after he shoots him the first time because Carl falls down. And so Wade has the gun there already cocked, but why doesn't he keep shooting at Carl? And I think he's just like, you know, he's an old man who's been shot and maybe doesn't have the strength to like lift up the gun or aim the gun or anything. And then Carl takes advantage and, you know, murders him.
Carl screams, puts the gun in his waistband, grabs the suitcase with the money, gets in the car, drives off, leaving Wade's body there. Carl pulls up to the ticket booth and once again have what I will call another moment of Minnesota nice, which was we've had all this violence and then this nice, you know, cashier says,
"May I have your ticket, please?"
Open the fucking gate!
Jerry pulls up on the garage roof, sees the body, and Jerry opens the trunk of his car. So did he just pick up Wade and put him in the trunk?
100%. And I love that they waited before. And this is a great shot. And this is what Mark's great directors. These little shots are what Mark great directors. The fact that he pulls up so that his car is in the background, Wade's body's in the foreground. And then the next shot is behind the car and we wait for a few beats, not 1 second, not one beat. It's a few beats. And then that trunk opens and you're like, oh, fuck. This guy is going to get rid of all the evidence. This guy is so amazing. You can say they're dumber or whatever, but I think people are much more conniving than they want to admit to themselves and play dumb. And in this moment, you see that Jerry is absolutely already adjusting the plan, troubleshooting the plan, figuring out what he's going to do next. Getting rid of Wade's body is the first thing so that I don't know what he's going to do with it. I don't know how he's going to hide the evidence or where he's going to put that body, but he absolutely put Wade's body in the trunk of the car, which is scary as hell.
I think, yes, I definitely think that is, he went, okay, I got to get the body. I don't think Jerry has any plan. I think when they arrest him at the motel later on, Wade's body's still in the trunk of that
probably,
car.
You're probably right.
And then I love him driving down and we see the broken gate of the ticket area and the slow POV shot of him driving by that ticket booth and seeing the bloody cashier is just great.
Jeez. It's so crazy that he says, oh, geez. Like, you know, what do you think's going on here, Jerry? Like, it's just amazing
how
he still has this kind of like, oh, what's all this happening? This is so weird.
We are now up to three people that were killed that night.
Yes.
His wife, that's four people are dead.
Right.
Wade is dead. That's five. And this guy who works at the parking garage is now, I think we're up to six dead people, right?
Now, do you think this is Carl's carryover from when the other parking station guy made him pay $4? Yes. Do you think this kid was like, oh, I can't open the gate unless you pay, sir? And then Carl just shot him.
No, because Carl is bleeding from his face. So he has other reasons to shoot this guy.
It's not, okay.
Yeah, because the guy's like, oh my God, he's going to call the police.
Oh, good point.
So you got to kill that guy.
Why does he even tell to open the fucking gate? That's so weird. But yeah,
that's true.
Hey, what's up, y'all? Kelly Clarkson with Wayfair. My favorite thing about the holidays, decking out my whole house. It's not a competition, but if it was, well, I'd win the season with Wayfair. Outdoor inflatable Santa, got it on Wayfair. Trees, lights, and ornaments, Wayfair. Hosting must-haves like dining sets, beds, sheets, and towels, Wayfair. For everything in your style delivered with fast and free shipping, visit Wayfair.com or the Wayfair app to win the season. But again, it's not a competition.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Jerry pulls up to his house, goes inside, just plops down on the stairs. We hear Scotty go,
Dad?
Yeah?
Stan Grossman called.
Yeah, okay.
Twice.
Okay.
Are you calling Stan?
And I love this because he just doesn't respond to that and says,
I'm going to bed now.
Yeah.
And I think he goes to bed. And I think Wade's body is in the fucking trunk of his car right now.
100%.
I think he's completely paralyzed. He has no idea what the fuck to do.
Right. He's got to think about it. He's got to figure out what he's going to do next. The framing of this is great, too. Him sitting alone in the hallway, right? He goes sit on the couch. He goes sit on. No, he's sitting on the bench in the hallway. He can't even get into the house proper before he has to sit down and think about what he's going to do next. It's amazing.
We got to a scene with characters who we don't know having a conversation. It's all in one shot. It is this cop who's talking to this witness. Initially, when they went to shoot the scene, their idea was that both of them would have their heads totally covered so that they have the hood up and you can't see their faces and you have two faceless people talking to each other. They shoot it once that way and they went, no, that's not going to work. We actually have to see people's faces for this whole scene. To me, this scene is just, it's the joy of listening to this dialogue.
Yeah.
That's what it is for me.
Yeah.
So I'm tending bar down there at Eklund and Swedlund's last Tuesday, and this little guy's drinking, and he says, so where can a guy find some action? I'm going crazy out there at the lake. And I says, what kind of action? And he says, woman action, what do I look like? And I says, well, what do I look like? I don't arrange that kind of thing.
It's so funny.
It's so great. It's so, you know, because he's like, I'm not that kind of person. It's so brilliantly done, the back and forth here.
He says, oh, so I get it. So you think I'm some kind of jerk for asking, only you don't use the word jerk.
I understand.
Then he calls me a jerk, says the last guy thought he's a jerk is dead now. So I don't say nothing. He says, what do you think about that? And I says, well, that don't sound like too good a deal for him then.
You got that right.
I just love the dialogue. I mean, I don't have any insightful comments on the deep meaning or character development or themes and illusions here. I just like listening to them talk.
Right. But just like Jerry surrendering too much information, here's Carl telling him he's out by the lake. Right. And so the bartender, obviously who's from that area, will know what lake they're at, you know?
Well, and this next bit is, let's face it, pretty damn suspicious.
Yeah, he says, yeah, that guy's dead, and I don't mean of old age. And then he says, geez, I'm going crazy out there at the lake.
White Bear Lake?
Yeah, well, at Eklund and Swedlund, that's closer to Moose Lake, so I made that assumption.
Oh, sure.
And again, we hear he's a little guy, kind of funny looking.
Yeah.
Cut to Carl's car parked by the side of the road, and he is looking through that briefcase full of money and seeing, John, there's a lot more than $80,000 in there.
And that's great because it adds more of the potential for, like, if they had just made different decisions. And that's what makes a great movie, a great thriller, a great noir, is like, if these people in critical moments had just made better decisions, they could have got away. They could have survived. They could have come out ahead.
Oh, yeah.
But they don't. And that's what makes a great movie, right? You know, that kind of stuff.
Maybe don't say you're staying out by the lake when you've kidnapped someone, like, and killed someone. Like,
maybe don't murder someone, because they'll be looking for you for sure. Yeah.
And let's be real clear. Buscemi looks terrible. I mean, his face is covered in blood. He's stuck like paper towels to stop the bleeding.
Yeah,
his hands are covered in blood. The money's all covered in blood.
Yeah, like it's a nosebleed or whatever.
Yeah. And he basically, he pulls out the $80,000 because he wants to keep all the rest of this money for himself. So he runs out of the car, makes it over to the fence, digs a hole in the snow with an ice scraper in his bare bloody hands. And then he puts the case in the hole, covers it with snow. And I'm just going, this is the worst plan. I mean, John, you've gone on long drives in the middle of nowhere. How the fuck would you ever know where this is?
Yeah, no, I'm, yeah, 100%. I would never do this. This makes no sense, right? But I mean, this is him thinking on the fly. Carl's not necessarily the smartest guy. You know, he likes to fancy himself as, you know, the point person with him and Gerard, but like, he's not the smartest guy. So this impromptu decision, anybody could find this. Anybody could come across it. The snow could melt. Like, there's all kinds of things that could happen before he gets back to this. And there's no guarantee that he won't be followed. So it's just like, there's so many factors here that he's thinking will work out for him. Yeah.
And again, the biggest one, you will never find this particular spot again. And I love the moment, like, oh, you stuck the ice scraper in, it's sticking up. And it's like a little breeze knocks that ice scraper open. Yeah. It's just like on, and it just is proof of how like completely nondescript this area is.
Yeah.
Here's how they shot it. Again, they had to make all this snow because they've got snow made on this run. Oh. And all they do is they do one take and he makes footsteps and digs a little hole. And then they move 10 feet further down the fence and they do take two, and then they move 10 feet further down the fence and take three, because it all looks exactly the fucking same.
Yes.
Which is why he's never going to find this money ever again.
Yeah. Which is great, because they make that clear to you as he looks to the left and looks to the right, and it all looks exactly the same as you said, Steve. Yeah, for sure.
Cut to Marge in the hotel room after, you know, I think we're still down in Minneapolis.
Yes.
She's obviously talking to a friend.
But you think he's all right? I saw him last night and...
What'd he say?
Well, it's nothing specific he said. It just seemed like it all hit him really hard. His wife dying.
His wife?
And this is it, John. This is this totally weird. We are now going to find out that whole scene was bullshit, because he was never married to this woman, Linda.
Yeah. And that Linda is still alive.
He was bothering Linda for about over a good year. Really pestering her. Wouldn't leave her alone.
And watching Frances McDormand react to this.
Yeah.
So, they never...
No, they never married. Mike's had psychiatric problems.
Because it totally convinced me that scene. I was 100% convinced that this poor sad guy had this crush on her and was married to this woman who died of leukemia. And that's not true.
And then she says, like, you know, he had psychiatric problems and he lives with his parents now. And there's a lot here for her to take in and consume, because now she feels betrayed, right? Because she may have come into that situation wanting to flirt with somebody and whatever. It doesn't mean she's a bad person. It's just, you know, kind of feeling wanted or a little bit. It's everybody in relationships has those moments, and it's nice when you have them if it's safe and you don't act on anything. But like, she had this, and then it completely turned, and now she had all this sympathy for him because of what he went through, and so it turned into something completely different. And so she's talking to her friend and just expressing her sadness for Mike, and then all this stuff that she thought she knew about this guy, and that she gave him her sympathy and her empathy and care in reaction to him, he took advantage of her in a way. And I imagine with Linda, he tried this act with Linda a year ago, and Linda gave into it, maybe even kissed him or gave him a pity lay, for lack of a better term, and then regretted it almost instantly because it made him even more addicted to her, and he was pestering her for a year probably to start the relationship, get going with the relationship, all of those kinds of things. And you know, that's the thing, when you grow up at certain times now, back then you were told like, you've got to, you know, win her over. You don't give up. You got to try over and over again. And the thing you realize, as I've said before, I think on the show, is that, you know, some women don't like that. A lot of women don't like it. When they say no, they mean no. And if they're not interested in you, you got to accept it. You're not going to convince them. I mean, it happens sometimes. Sure. It's a interesting world. But like, most of the time when they tell you no, it's because they don't have an interest. And you pestering them, you'll break them down maybe to get a drink with you, but it's just so that you'll stop, you know? And so I think that's what you see with Mike. He's so far down that pathetic path, he has to find his way back, you know?
You know, the phrase that was going through my head as you were speaking is the banality of evil. Is that, which I think comes from an article written about like the Adolf Eichmann trials or something like that.
Yeah.
But, because the thing about it is, I think, because movies are almost always inherently sexy, on some level.
Right.
Nine times out of 10, we cast actors that are well beyond the average level of attractiveness. They are smart. Camera moves are exciting. And this goes even to the idea of Roger Deakins talking about that they wanted to make this movie look really ordinary.
Yeah.
This movie is not sexy. Like the characters. And so what I think is so interesting about guys, particularly like Jerry, Carl, and Mike Yamaguchi is that this is the banality of evil. These are ordinary people that there's almost this weird way that I feel like cinema has misled us to believe certain things look a certain way. And so that evil is exciting or thrilling or sexy or all these things or brilliant, you know, and instead it's these schlubs that literally cause all these deaths. And even though Mike is not a murderer, obviously, as far as we know, but still, like, would he have slept with Marge, that pregnant Marge, that night?
100%.
Yes, he would have under all these false circumstances, you know? And so, and again, and it's Frances McDormand taking all of that in at this scene that is what makes it so powerful, I think. Mm-hmm. She's driving. We're hearing that great Carter Burwell score, which, by the way, I should say is based on a Norwegian folk song, this particular piece of music.
Nice.
She stops at Hardee's, as you do.
Oh, man.
She's eating in the car. And then you can literally see her have a thought, you know.
I miss Hardee's. Hardee's is amazing.
Is Hardee's Cardles Jr.? Are they the same?
On the East Coast or in the Midwest as well, I suppose. Yeah. And there used to be a Roy Rogers. Did they have a Roy Rogers on the West Coast?
Probably. No, it's the East Coast. Yeah. We cut to Jerry. So this is completing her thought. She hears the thing that this sad sack of a guy was lying to her, and she has this thought, and we go, what is the thought that she just had?
Right.
Well, somehow she connected him to Mike Yamaguchi and wanted to go talk to him again.
Yeah.
And he is... as nervous as he was the last time we saw him, he is at a whole other level now.
Yeah, because we see him purposely shaving down the lead on the pencil on a pad so that when he writes the numbers down, they're slightly illegible. Slightly illegible. Mm. So again, this is a crafty SOB, a conniving SOB. He knows he's sending a form here that's an utter lie to the GMAC people to try to please them and give him more time, delay the time so he can get away with the whole situation and get out of there before they catch him. So you see, he's in the middle of committing a crime here as she walks in, you know.
Well, and I think Wade's body is still sitting in the trunk of
his
car.
Great points, probably, yeah.
I like that she starts with the same line about,
do you mind if I sit down? Carrying a bit of a load here.
And he is instantly very defensive.
Like I told you, we haven't had any vehicles go missing.
Okay. Are you sure? Because, I mean, how do you know? Because, see, the crime I'm investigating, the perpetrators were driving a car with dealer plates, and they called someone who works here, so it'd be quite a coincidence if they weren't, you know, connected.
I love Frances McDormand and everything she does.
The car's not from our lot, ma'am.
But how do you know that for sure without doing a...
Well, I would know. I'm the executive sales manager.
And she keeps pushing him, and the more she pushes him, the more defensive he becomes.
Yeah.
You could see the wheels turning of, like, I need to be really strong with her.
Yes.
To get her to stop asking me questions. So he goes,
ma'am, I answered your question.
I'm sorry, sir.
Ma'am, I answered your question. I answered the darn... I'm cooperating here, and there's no...
So... a thought occurs to me as we talk about this scene, right? Because Marge is putting on an act as well.
Oh, yeah.
Just as Mike put on an act, just as Jerry put on an act, just as Wade put on this masculine act. So a lot of these people in this world, and this is, I imagine, is the point of the Minnesota Nice thing, a lot of these people put on an act to hide who they really are, right? Marge is doing it in a police capacity. You can say it's an official capacity, right? Even Carl is putting on an act for an escort at the Jose Feliciano concert. So, like, the film is littered with people putting on acts in order to achieve something. Her goal here is to get the information and the truth out of Jerry because now she suspects him because of Mike Yanagita. But, like, the situation in the back and forth here, she's initially playing the whole, I don't know, playing all of that. But then when he snaps at her, you see all the niceness slide right out of Marge's face, and she is like, the fuck you say? And you can tell by her face, you know? And I think that's so great. Now you're seeing the real Marge, right? There's a nicety that she puts on to get through life and deal with the dumb men that she works with at her job. Not all of them, obviously, but Norm and others. But here in this moment with Jerry, I think there's a remnants of Mike fooling her, and now Jerry's trying to fool her, and she is done with it. And now we see the real Marge, the don't fuck with Marge type Marge, and I think that's great.
Well, and I think you're totally right, too, in the sense, I don't think that she thought about the Mike Yanagita story, thought of Jerry, and therefore concluded that he is behind these grisly murders or anything like that. I don't think she was thinking that.
Not that far, no.
No, I think she was going... Yeah. Something weird's going on here. But now that Jerry's being so defensive, this is getting a lot weirder.
I think she sensed that he might be lying to her, but I don't think she knew to the extent. And I think this is where it starts to reveal itself because of his behavior.
Well, heck, if you wanna play games here, I'm working with you on this thing here, but okay. I'll do a damn luck count.
Sir, right now?
Yeah, right now. You're darn tootin'.
This is very similar to Carl yelling at Wade on the rooftop, right? Because he says to him, if you want to play games, Carl said to Wade, you think I'm fucking playing games here? Am I playing a game? And so you see that there's as you were connecting the two earlier in this particular episode, brother, and this is even more evidence of how connected Carl and Jerry are, because they both react when they're pressured. They're both reacting the same way, which is overreaction, emotional outburst, bordering on childish tantrums. And then, you know, committing an act. Carl commits the act of killing Wade, and Jerry's about to commit the act of fleeing the scene, fleeing the interview, rather, as Marge is about to say over and over again, which I think is great.
So he's like angrily putting on his parka and grabbing his hat, and she's kind of going, what the hell's going on? I love at the end.
What? I'm sorry, sir.
What the Christ.
Like, and then so he heads out. To ostensibly do an inventory count. And she sits down and she's kind of looking around the room, sees the picture of the wife, looks at some of the scribbled numbers, which I think are those VIN numbers from the loan.
Yeah.
And then she sees him driving off the lot.
Pete's sake, he's fleeing the interview. He's fleeing the interview.
So great.
I love the moment when he looks at the picture of the wife, right? Because she almost has a smile, it's an interesting disconnect. Because she sees the picture of the wife, and there is they stay on Frances McDormand's face, and she has a smile and a tilt of the head, as if like, oh, she seems like good people. You know what I'm saying? And here she is suspecting this man of something, not quite sure what it is, but then is still able to appreciate this Olin Mills shot of his wife there in the frame, which I think is, again, another way that you can keep this character as a good person in this crazy world of Fargo. Because she is nice at heart.
Yeah.
And then that's when she looks up and then notices as she looks through the window that Jerry is fleeing the scene of the crime. So these little character beats are really, nonverbal character beats are really smart by great filmmakers to give more levels to the characters that they have.
100%. We cut to Gare sitting in his long underwear, watching nothing but static on the TV.
No, there's some program behind the static. It looks like a talk show or something. But yeah, we can hear that they're having the back and forth. So he's just like one of these housewives sitting in the middle of the day watching like something like this, which I think is hilarious. So I don't know if I think it's a soap opera or something that he's watching, but he is like engrossed in it through the static, which is great.
Yeah. And the door opens and in comes Carl looking horrendous and covered in blood. I am certain he thought about this line 30 miles ago that he was going to say when he walked in.
You should see the other guy.
Just like Wade, just like Jerry. I agree with you, Steve. There's probably a scene they shot where Carl is in the car practicing what he's going to say to Garrett. It's so true.
And then he notices Jean's dead body on the floor.
Fuck happened to her?
She started shrieking, you know.
Jesus.
And there's no sadness over this additional murder. Carl couldn't give two shits at this point. Puts the money down. Here's how we're going to split it.
You could have my truck. I'm taking Sierra.
And he wants to be just out the fucking door.
Right.
Garrett doesn't like this deal.
We split that.
How the fuck do you split a fucking car, you dummy? With a fucking chainsaw?
One of us pays the other for half.
Which, perfectly reasonable business deal. I believe that that actually would be fair.
Hold on. No fucking way. You fucking notice this? I got fucking shot. I got fucking shot in the face. I went and got the fucking money. I got shot fucking picking it up. I've been up for 36 fucking hours.
And he's done. He's laying down the law, and he thinks he has all the power. He goes,
I'm taking that fucking car. That fuck is mine, you fucking asshole. You know, I've been listening to your fucking bullshit all week.
I love that line so much.
When he has, when he hasn't been talking to him at all.
Yeah, exactly. But Carl's put in his brain these other responses that were never there.
Yeah.
And then, and again, he's totally planned this out, and it goes back to what you were talking about masculinity, because he goes, are we square? Yeah. And then he shows him the gun and asks again.
Are we square? Yeah, you fucking mute.
And Carl thinks that he's won.
Oh, and also says, when I see your friend, Shep Proudfoot, I'm going to nail his ass.
Yeah.
So not only does he insult him, not only does he try to work out a deal that's in his favor, he also threatens his friend. I don't know what this moron thought he was doing in this moment, because again, as I said earlier about like these noirs, he has way more than the cost of the Sierra sitting in a fucking basket, sitting in a suitcase in the middle of the snow that he's going to go get. But again, it's just like the $4 at the parking garage. If he wasn't such a cheap asshole, he'd have gotten out of this whole situation with way more money. Do I think he would have been stupid and spending it on a lot of things, and Garrard would have figured out what happened and chased him down and killed him? 100%. But still, in this moment, he could have at least gotten away for a few more days or a few more weeks if he hadn't been so angry about Garrard not talking to him and tried to nickel and dime Garrard over the Cutlass Sierra. It's such a dumb move.
Yep.
And we see what happens next.
What he should have done was say, I guess you're right. And argue a little bit about the cost of the Sierra.
Yep.
Give in eventually, hand him an extra $8,000
100%.
For half of the Sierra.
Yep.
And then you're maybe good. Say, don't say anything about Shep Proudfoot and get the fuck out.
Yeah. And get the fuck out. Yeah.
This next shot is astounding.
Yeah.
And it's one of those, like, is it fancy, beautiful? No, it's just, he said goodbye. He's heads out the door.
Right.
He's outside walking away from the house. And behind him, over his shoulder, even partially obscured, you see the door open and Gare comes out. In a split second, you realize that he has an axe. Carl turns, and in that same another split second, he sees the axe.
Yeah.
But there is absolutely no time for him to do anything other than start to scream as he gets hit. And then we immediately go to black.
Here's what's great about the whole situation here when he walks out. He still took a moment to put on his hat because his ears might get cold. I think it's just like, why would you care about
that? It's really cold out, John.
But it's cold. Exactly. I love that he puts the hat on and then walks out there with the axe. And the thing is, he's just killed Gene. Why? Another reason, why are you trying to agitate this man? But no, it's like a little dog barking at the big dog. That's exactly what you're seeing here, which I always like go crazy at when I see little dogs barking at big dogs. Because what happens to a little dog's mind that they think they can go toe-to-toe with a large dog? I've seen so many little dogs get attacked by large dogs when they try that bullshit at dog parks and other places, and I never understand it. And here it is yet again in human form, because Buscemi is not a big dog at all. He's a small dog chirping at the big dog who isn't going to move until the dog is ready to move. And when it does, it's full rage and ferocity just takes him out with an axe. It's amazing, you know? And it's such a brutal, scary scene. And that's what makes this film so great, Steve. The mixture of the comedy with the really dark, unsettling, scary moments, you know?
You know, it just occurred to me, this is very much what happened to Wade, which is Wade went into a situation
he
didn't understand, felt that he could intimidate the other side,
right.
You know, felt that he could impose his will on someone, and then instantly and shockingly, he got killed.
Yep.
And that's exactly what's just happened to Carl.
Yeah.
And again, this just goes to the genius of the Coen brothers. They understood what they needed from that shot.
Yep.
And it's very fast.
Yeah.
And it's very shocking. And then they go to black. And it's haunting because I think what's haunting about that shot, and again, it's very similar to the death of Wade, is that there's just this like, oh, everything can turn in a second. In a second, you can be dead.
And we as the audience, we feel helpless. Like see the axe coming before Carl does.
Yes.
And so by the time Carl turns around, it's too late. Where it's like, oh my God, even though Carl just finished murdering someone a few hours ago, it still unsettles us that he's going to go down by axe, which is somehow so much more brutal, you know?
And then we hear in the black.
His wife, this guy says she was kidnapped last Wednesday.
The day of our homicides.
Yeah.
And this guy was who?
Lundegaard's father-in-law's accountant.
Which means Stan Grossman saves the day. I'm assuming what happened is that when Wade didn't check in after the exchange and Stan called Jerry's house and talked to Scotty twice, we know, and Jerry never called him back, that eventually, you know, 6 hours later, Stan called the police.
Stan put two and two together, I think. Yep, 100%.
Where are you, Margie?
Oh, I'm almost back. I'm taking a drive around Moose Lake.
Oh, Gary's loudmouth.
Yeah, the loudmouth.
Frances McDormand is so cute. when she sees the car.
There's the car! There's the car!
Whose car?
My car! Tan Sierra!
She's just so happy and excited.
Yeah, when I first saw the movie, I was like, this is too much of a coincidence, right? But I always forget the scene with the dude saying the loudmouth and the Bear Lake or whatever.
Moose Lake,
Yeah, it was such a, you know, sometimes when I watch movies, those scenes kind of get lost in my mind because they're kind of, they seem like tossaway scenes. But no, those are actually important scenes that yield some results. And sure enough, you know, when you watch it again, she's driving around that area because that other sheriff gave her the information. And so she's just doing her due diligence and just sees the car randomly because she's looking for it, you know?
She parks, and the cop she's talking to on the radio says,
okay, you're careful, Margie. I'll send a couple cars.
And she gets out and closes the door. And I think the movie at this moment
becomes
really scary.
Yes, it does, because he just chopped a dude up with an axe.
With an axe. And she doesn't know what she's walking into. We know what she's walking into. Right. We've gotten to say, even though Garrett hasn't said very much this whole movie, like, he's the scariest dude in the movie.
Yes.
I mean, I think he's scarier than Shep Proudfoot because we just don't even understand Garrett, you know?
No, Garrett is scarier, 100%. Yeah.
And so she's walking up, this nice pregnant lady who we've just come to adore is walking towards this psycho killer, you know? And she's coming up through the trees on the snow. We hear the sound of some kind of machinery. We don't know what's going on. She walks quietly up towards this house. And by the way, this is one of the few tracking shots in the whole movie. Most of the movie, the camera is still. Now the camera is moving with her. She pulls out her revolver and that machine sound. I don't know what it is, but it's getting louder and louder. And then we see her move out from behind a branch and she sees something. And still we don't know what she sees. And she makes a face.
Yeah.
And then we see her POV as she's coming through the trees and there's just... The first thing we see just doesn't, I don't think it visually makes sense because you just see this long streak of red in the snow.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like, well, what can that be? And then we see Garrett standing at the wood chipper with red pouring out of the wood chipper. And I think we figure it out.
Yeah.
Pretty quick. She comes forward, gun drawn. And we see now he's pushing something down in the wood chipper. The music comes in and we realize that thing he's pushing down into the wood chipper is a foot.
Yeah.
She raises her gun and she calls out.
Police!
But the wood chipper is so loud that he doesn't hear her at first.
Yeah. Yeah.
And just, it's perfectly practical. What he does next makes perfect sense. He's having trouble getting the ice cold, rock hard, frozen shin bone and foot into the wood chipper. So he grabs a log. As you do, force it down further into the wood chipper just makes sense.
It's such this whole scene. I mean, if you know, you talk about plussing things in movies or in, you know, in TV shows and what have you. The axe chopping moment was so horrific for us watching it. And then to plus it by having him use a wood chipper to get rid of Carl's body. And by the way, I only noticed it this time for the first time. There's still parts of his body on the ground under a tarp that you can see. Right. I was so I've always been so focused on the leg this time around. I think because my TV is a little bit bigger than when I watched it when I was younger. You see the other parts on the ground. You're like, oh my God, this is like a whole operation. And so I wondered this time around, like, when did he decide he was going to chop him up and put him in the wood chipper? Had he always been planning this in order to get his money? Was the ruse of the Cutlass Sierra just to kind of mess with him a little bit? Or did he think once Carl yelled at him the way he did he go, you know what? I'm going to cut him up and shove him into the wood chipper. And he just knew he was going to do that. And so it's just the whole planning out of this in a split second, in a split moment, speaks to the kind of psychopath this fucker is. And he is the really truly evil person in the whole movie. Like, you know, Jerry and Carl are just sad sacks, right? And of course they're evil in doing the things that they do. But Gerard is a person with literally no fucking care for human life. And it's so unsettling to see a body being taken care of in this way, you know?
I think there is a cognitive dissonance with Jerry that is not there with Gerard, which is that Jerry, he just needs the money. He's not really thinking about the consequences of I think in his mind, he's just going to do this little embezzlement thing and he's going to get the $1 million and then he's going to go back and live happily with Gene and Scotty. And except now he's going to have a lot of money and then eventually Wade's going to die and he's going to live happily ever after. I don't think he's thinking in fact, his inability to see all the fucking consequences that his choices are making is part of what makes him such a terrible person.
Exactly. Exactly.
Whereas I think I don't know for sure, but my feeling is that Gerard, like, I think his brain is empty until he makes the decision to do the thing. And then he 100% knows what he's going to do next and does it.
Right.
You know?
100%. Yeah. You could argue a state of arrested development because he's sitting there watching a soap opera, which he probably did when he was, you know, young and always did this. And this is his way of just kind of working through his life, you know?
Yeah. She yells police again, and this time he sort of hears her, turns over, sees her. I love that she gestures to the badge on her hat.
She points at the badge.
Yeah. And he just takes off running across this frozen lake. Yeah. She fires at him, misses the first time, then hits him in the leg, and he goes down. By the way, totally small thing, but we see the price tag on the boot as he goes down. That was not intentional, but it's very common because frequently when you're buying costumes,
right,
you go to the used clothing store and you get like 10 different pairs of boots and you're going to probably return most of them that you're not going to use. Yeah. But they had the price tag got left on by accident and they actually really liked it. So they're like, no, this is good. Let's see that price tag.
Yeah.
It happens very quickly. And I actually, in my headcanon, Marge is an excellent shot.
Yes, you know, clearly. She shot to stop him.
Yep.
From running. But when he didn't stop running, she shot him in the leg. She isn't an irresponsible user of her weapon. Like, she's just not going to shoot. As we see, sadly, unfortunately, some people in the force do pump out the entire clip into one person who's posing no threat or just sitting there. And seeing her do that, I think is brilliant. What's shocking to me is that, and this speaks volumes to Gerard, is that, like, well, they're police. I can't attack police. Like, why? He could have absolutely killed her and put her in the wood chipper next after. But
except he doesn't have I don't think he has a gun on him.
Right. He doesn't. Right. She's got a gun. He doesn't. Right. Yeah. Exactly. So when he throws the 2x4 to distract her, it's not enough. And then she does shoot. But she does cuff him and bring him into the car. So, like, that's a Herculean task that she does. And pulls off speaks volumes
for this nice pregnant lady.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
So we're driving in the car.
So that was Mrs. Lundegaard on the floor in there. And I guess that was your accomplice in the wood chipper. And those three people in Brainerd. And for what? For a little bit of money.
And she's just, I think, really deeply moved by the stupidity and the waste of all this, you know?
Yeah, I agree that I don't know how much of this she's had experience with in Brainerd, you know, and seeing it this way and seeing the uselessness of it all and the waste of it all, the waste of human life of it all. It really kind of puts her in this place. Like, I think she's changed from this whole case and sequence of events. Yeah.
There's more to life than a little money, you know. Don't you know that?
I like that line a lot. Don't you know that? Mm. Because I think it's an obvious thing to her. Of course there's more to life than money. But I don't, it's just what you're saying. I think this realization that he actually doesn't know that there's more to life than money is important.
Yeah.
And here you are. And it's a beautiful day.
I've seen some people speculate that this back and forth with him is a little bit about her as well. Like her realizing and reappreciating what she has with her husband, what she has with her life, what, you know, because maybe we don't know this, but maybe we've caught her at a moment of, you know, where she's wondering if she's doing the right thing with her life, if she's happy with her life. And the back and forth with him almost reiterates it, you know, and her saying after that, like, I just don't understand it, you know, and because for her, it's so out of the realm of something that she would ever conceive of doing with her life, you know.
Well, I think part of it, now that she kind of can see what the whole story was.
Yeah,
is that this is all so stupid.
Yes.
It all starts with Jerry's stupid fucking plan that makes no sense. And then it's further complicated by every single stupid decision that was made along the way. And that resulted in all of these deaths and all this violence for no reason. Nothing was accomplished, you know?
Most crime is utterly stupid because most crime could be solved by just like speaking your truth about what's happening and speaking your needs out. And unfortunately, that's not what happens a majority of the time. You know, people think they can cheat, scheme, lie, steal, finagle, manipulate, whatever, and or kill. And it always leads to, you know, bad stuff.
And we have this heavy, somber music again, and we see those cars coming up in slow motion.
I just don't understand it.
And this was shot on the same day as the opening of the movie, which is that one day that they had snow. That's when they shot all this.
It looks
and like, just like the opening of the movie, the cars, nothing exactly matches, but it doesn't matter. It all totally works. We have this high angle of this motel in the middle of nowhere. We're off in Bismarck, North Dakota. We see cop cars. We see officers walking up to this door. They knock.
Mr. Anderson?
Who?
Mr. Anderson.
I love the Mr. Anderson who, because it means he checked into the motel on a false name, but then forgot the name that he had checked in under.
Could you open the door, please?
Yeah, just a sec.
They have the manager open the doors. They have their guns drawn and they charge in and grab him just as he's trying to head out the bathroom window in his underwear. And he just screams and fights trying to get away, and they put him on the bed and handcuff him as he just pitifully screams.
I have to say, this scene is just as harrowing for me as the axe scene with Carl. In a different way, right? Carl gets the axe, literally. But with Jerry, this is just as bad as being killed and cut up and put in a wood chipper because he's going to have to be made to face the consequences of what he did.
Yep.
And everyone in the town is going to know who he was. Everyone's going to know what he did. And his son's going to know what he did. Stan's going to know what he did. His wife's family's going to know what he did. His own family's going to know what he did. And so everyone will know. And you could argue that Brainerd's a bit of a kind of a small town, not really a big metropolis. So a bit of a small town. Yeah. Everyone's going to know it. And so the screaming is because it sounds almost teenager or childlike, the screaming of like, this, all of it is so unsettling. William H. Macy goes to a register that is of a pathetic, like almost like you hear when you watch a nature documentary and a lion kills a jackal or kills whatever it kills, or a leopard or a cheetah kills what it kills. You can hear the smaller prey going, wah, as it's biting its neck. That's exactly what you're seeing, is that squeal of pain, knowing that death or some form of death is around the corner. And for him, losing his name, reputation, and status and being found out for the criminal he is a form of death, you know?
You know, it goes with sort of what we've been saying this whole time, is like, I think Carl and Jerry are terrible people. And yet the moment that the axe comes out, I feel bad. It's very upsetting. And this moment is very upsetting.
Agreed.
Because it's totally real. And it's, your description is perfect. Like, it's just the the ineffectualness. And it's like you can see, and this is this magical thing that movies can do, is in some weird way, you can see Jerry's whole future, the horribleness of his whole future in this moment.
Yeah, 100%, right?
And then we cut to the most horrible sequence on a bed to another bed where it's Norm just sitting very peacefully, as opposite of Jerry as anyone can be. And Marge comes in and he says,
"They announced it."
"They announced it?"
"Yeah."
"So?"
"3 cent stamp."
"You're Mallard?"
"Yeah."
So he has not won the contest, but he has gotten the lesser prize, which is the 3 cent stamp. And he is not happy about it.
"It's just a 3 cent."
"It's terrific."
"Hoffman's Blue Wing Teal got the 29 cent. People don't much use the 3 cent."
And so Norm is down on himself because he didn't win the contest like he wanted to. And now Marge is going to bring up his confidence. That's going to be our final scene of the movie.
It's beautiful, you know, because
it's beautiful.
We haven't had much time with them. And when we have had time with them, there are genuine moments of affection between them, you know, whether they're eating together at the buffet, whether he's bringing her lunch, making her eggs. And in this moment, she's giving back to him like all these, a different way to look at it. Let me tell you, that's a partner that is so helpful in life and so necessary in life when you're doing the things you're doing. And look, in a way, you could argue that Norm's an artist because he is a painter.
He's an artist.
You know? And so, so her supporting him when he's got any measure of success, I think, is so essential for any artist to hear. And so I think she appreciates him even more after all of this, right? And I think this exchange is kind of hammering that point home.
Well, what was the previous scene with her and Gare about? She says there's more to life than a little money, you know?
Yeah.
This is what life's about. This moment with her, with Norm. And she does exactly what you need to do, which is he's down on himself because people don't use the 3 cent stamp.
"Oh, for peace. Of course they do. Whenever they raise the postage, people need the little stamps."
"Yeah."
"When they're stuck with a bunch of the old ones."
I just think, and it's such, this is so what happens in relationships. It's like, is that a little bit lame? Yeah, it's a little bit lame. But this is what you give to your spouse.
Yeah, of course.
When they're down in this moment.
Yes. You. Because you don't want them, moping, you know, and you want to validate them and what they did. And sometimes, you know, when you're shooting for something higher and you get a little bit less, you can really get down on yourself without having the perspective of you still got something, which is really important, you know, because a lot of people don't. You know?
And you know what I was saying before about the sexiness of most movies and that that's not really here. That's what makes this scene so moving to me. And I really do tear up every time in the scene.
"It's terrific. I'm so proud of you, Norm. Heck, Norm, you know, we're doing pretty good."
And he leans his head on hers and says,
"I love you, Margie."
"I love you, Norm."
Two more months.
It really gets me.
Yeah. It's a beautiful way to end a film that showcases the horrible side of humanity by showing the beautiful side of humanity with these two and their relationship, and that she doesn't bring her work home with her, right? Which I think is another element of this that's really important and interesting.
I think it's such a movie about the simple things, because it's like you have Jerry and Gare and Carl and all these people scrambling, desperate to get money to make them happy, and it's like, no, you could just compliment your spouse on their 3 cent stamp, you know, duck painting and cuddle in bed as you wait for the baby to show up and make each other eggs and bring each other night crawlers and bring each other Arby's or Hardee's or whatever we're eating. You know, like that's actually what the good stuff is. Yeah. That little scene in the car where she says, "Oh, you don't know that money's not everything and it's a beautiful day." That's the point of this, you know, of what's going on here.
Yeah.
So we have reached the end of Fargo. It was nominated for the Palme d'Or at Cannes. It won for Joel Coen for Best Director. It grossed $60 million at the box office on a $7 million budget.
That's amazing.
Huge success. It was Siskel and Ebert both called it the best movie of 1996. Ebert ranked it as number 4 of all of the 90s.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
And there are a lot of good movies in the 90s. Let's be real clear.
There are.
It was nominated for Best Picture, Best Director, Actress, Supporting Actor for William H. Macy, and Screenplay, Cinematography, and Editing. Frances McDormand won for Actress, deservedly so. Mm. It won for Screenplay. This is Cuba Gooding Jr.'s year for Jerry Maguire, and he beat William H. Macy for this. There's no comparison in my mind whatsoever.
Yeah, I have to agree with that. That's such an unusual, but the supporting actors and actresses is always a toss-up.
It's always weird.
It's always a weird category to predict, but yeah. Yeah, William H. Macy now, clearly his performance has aged much better than Cuba Gooding's.
Yeah, Jerry Maguire is one of those movies where I totally liked it. I've never seen what everyone loves about that movie. Like, I like it. It's fun, but I don't love it, you know?
I don't disagree with you. I love Tom Cruise. I like that movie, but there's something missing from that movie and the chemistry between him and Renee Zellweger that I don't 100% buy. Yeah, I agree with you.
This, by the way, is the year of a movie that I know that you love, which is This is the Year of the English Patient. So it wins for Best Picture, Cinematography, Directing, and Editing.
And I don't care what you all say, rightfully so. I know some of you hate English Patient. I know you. I've seen you talk about it on your message boards. But I love The English Patient. And this is also the year of another beautiful movie that I hope we tackle one day, Steve, and that is Shine.
I love Shine. Totally. Yeah.
I think that's a film that you and I would really do justice to for a number of reasons. The father-son stuff, the art, the artistic stuff, and then, you know, what happens to him throughout the movie and the Rachmaninoff, which I've never forgotten. So it's like it's one of those films that I would love to explore sometime on the Cinephiles for sure. But yes, I defend English Patient with my dying breath.
I watched it multiple times because I worked on the DVD.
Mm.
I have not watched it since.
Which one? English Patient?
English Patient.
Oh, wow.
It'd be interesting to watch that one. It's been a long time. So when it finally came out that this was not based on a true story, the Coen brothers released a statement. And their statement was, "We are doing an internal investigation to find out how something like this happened. And trust us, it will be an intense internal investigation because we want to assure our public that they can expect quality entertainment from us in the future. And we assure them nothing like this will ever happen again."
Amazing.
So I'll give my final thoughts first.
Oh, sure.
Here's the thought that really occurred to me is that to some degree, the really great movies aren't like anything else. It's like we could say Citizen Kane, and you and I will both argue that Citizen Kane is the greatest film ever made.
Sure.
And you would think a movie that's groundbreaking would have all these imitators, but it really doesn't. Mm. Citizen Kane is like Citizen Kane. There isn't another movie like Citizen Kane. I don't think there's another movie like Fargo. I think Fargo is what it is. It is there's no movie set like this. There's no movie that has sort of the structure like this, that weird combination of really brutal humanity and scariness and humor in this Minnesota Nice thing. I don't think there's a hero like Marge Gunderson anywhere else in all of cinema. I think these performances are totally unique. I think the approach of it. And I think if you went to a studio executive and said, "Here's the movie I wanted to make," and showed him the script, they wouldn't know what the hell you were doing. It's like only someone, that's why, you know, this isn't financed in the studio system. It's financed through Europe, and it's in this, you know, complicated way, shot for a low budget. It doesn't look like any other movie. It doesn't feel like any other movie. The characters aren't like any other movie. It is its own thing. Now, there are movies that are not their own thing that are still great films. That's certainly true. Like Jaws is a movie where it is like a lot of other movies. It's also unlike a lot of other movies. This movie is it exists in its own place. And every single time I watch it, I have a ton of fun. I'm very disturbed. Yes. I love the characters. Mike Yanagita gets me sucked in every single time. Like every time I'm like with him, but when I have to remind myself that he's lying, like it is an absolutely fascinating movie top to bottom. And this is why I'm thrilled that the Coen brothers exist. What are your thoughts?
This was so great to revisit this movie with you and do it here on the Cinephiles, because I'll be honest with you, this is not one of those films I run to watch because it really does unsettle me. It's one of these films that pierces through what we watch in movies as like, oh, this is a noir or a caper film or a crime film or a thriller. This one cuts a little too close to reality. This one feels like it could be real, which is why, based on a true story, people didn't question it for years until it was finally exposed, because the story and the way it's laid out here, and you could argue this could have been one of the first movies that sparked the true crime fascination that we've had for decades now with people that has grown and spawned into these massive podcasts and shows. I mean, Dateline, all of that stuff is a cottage industry now. But this film feels like you're watching, in essence, a dramatization of an actual true story, because some of the actions here are human, are tragic. There are so many decisions that could have been made that changed the course of this movie for all of these characters that weren't made. And so there's a overwhelming sense of tragedy around this movie as well, and heartbreak of what could have been, but also showing you, like, your fellow human being might be more insidious, might be more manipulative, might be more conniving than you want to admit. So it's a film that is unsettling in a lot of ways beyond the horror movie sequences, like the acts and whatever you, it's what humans are capable of. And that is something that is probably more scary than any scene in a horror film. And this film really captures it well. Great direction, great writing, great performances, and all of that mixed into it as well.
So that's what we think of Fargo, and we'd love to hear your thoughts and your thoughts in general about this season of the Coen Brothers. You can always visit us on Facebook by doing a search for The Cinephiles. It's Cine_Files on X, The Cinephiles Podcast on Instagram. Check us out there. You can subscribe to the show at all the usual places. And if you have subscribed on Apple Podcasts, please leave us a review. They're very, very helpful to the show. Take you only a couple of minutes. And you can also leave your comments on Spotify. Comments on YouTube are also fun. You can buy or stream Fargo along with every other film we've ever done at cinephiles.net. And you could support the show at patreon.com/thecinephiles, where you can get ad-free versions of the show, access to our Cinephiles shorts. We just did a watch-along of Raising Arizona. Mm. That's exclusively available on Patreon. And you can also join our Cinephiles advisory board. And of course, if you want to reach me, the easiest place is on Twitter at SR Morris or SR Morris 1 on Instagram. John, how would people reach you?
You can always reach me at The Roca Says on Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, The Outlaw Nation on Twitch, and my YouTube channel, youtube.com/John Roca Says, where you can see all the stuff I've got going on there, all the big shows that are happening there on the channel.
And I think that's it for this week. And this will also conclude our season of the Coen Brothers. And we're going to be coming back. Our next movie that we're doing a deep dive on, we are returning to the MCU because it has been 10 years since the movie Ant-Man came out. So that is Ant-Man next time on The Cinephiles.